Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Today, two-thirds of Americans are overweight, and fully one-third are defined as obese, which explains why we have an epidemic of diabetes. New research on diabetes demonstrates that it's the increase in the amount of fat intertwined between our muscle cells that leads to the body's inability, or resistance, to using the insulin our pancreas produces. It's not only diabetes, but sex hormones like estrogen and testosterone, as well as thyroid hormone that controls our metabolism, that can get out of whack on the standard American diet, a diet high in animal-based protein and fat, as well as processed foods loaded with added sugar and salt. In a new book called Your Body in Balance, Dr. Neil Barnard explores the health virtues of plant-based eating in regard to hormonal control. Barnard is an adjunct associate professor of medicine at George Washington University and president and founder of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. He's appeared in well-known documentaries about nutrition, including Forks Over Knives and What the Health, among many others. His new book includes recommendations on food, lifestyle change, and it also includes more than 60 recipes by his collaborator, Lindsay Nixon. Dr. Neil Barnard, author of Your Body in Balance, The New Science of Food, Hormones, and Health, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Neil Barnard, welcome to Medical Monday. Your new book, Your Body in Balance, discusses the new science of food and hormones and how they impact our health. What is the new science here, and how is it that nutrition directly impacts our hormones?
Well, you know, the new science is that there are couples that are in a fertility clinic, and they're struggling for years, never realizing that the reason they're having problems with fertility is what they ate for breakfast or lunch. Or there's a young woman who's struggling with menstrual cramps. One day every month, she can't get out of bed, practically. And she had no idea that maybe this could relate to foods. Or there's a man with erectile dysfunction who's got the same issue, and he never thought that foods could be the issue. Or a person who has cancer in their family. They never think of food. What all of these conditions have in common is that they're hormonal. Hormones play a role. And if you can use foods to change your hormones, you have power over a vast array of conditions. And for me as a doctor, I got so excited about the power that we had no idea that we had. You can change your diet and do a whole lot more than just shrink your waistline and lower your cholesterol. You can affect your health in very, very fundamental ways. And yet, people don't know about it, and often their doctors are not aware of it either.
Yeah, so I guess I was vaguely aware, of course, of the importance of nutrition. I've become increasingly aware just in recent years, but I guess the more direct link specifically with hormones, both sex hormones or thyroid hormone, for example, was pretty new to me. So I guess how did this knowledge become available to you? Are you just steeped in it? And you have several stories in the book, anecdotes. How did those come to you?
A couple of different ways. And one was actually just a complete guess, really, on my part. I was sitting at my desk and the phone rang, and it was a young woman who couldn't get out of bed. She had terrible menstrual cramps. And maybe 1 in 10 women has cramps that are so bad that it's really bad for a day every month. They aren't going to work that day. That was her situation. And she said, could I give her some strong painkillers? And I said, of course, sure. But I started thinking, well, this is going to come back again next month. And the month after that, what are we going to do? And so I made a suggestion to her, an educated guess. I said, would you like to try an experiment with your diet? How about no animal products for the next month? I'm going to make you into a vegan. And keep oils really low. So if you fry stuff, stop doing that. Keep oils really low. And she had no idea why I would suggest such an outlandish thing, but she agreed to give it a try. And the next month, she called me back, and her period had arrived with zero symptoms, no symptoms at all. She said, this is miraculous. This is amazing. And she kept up with the diet, and she was pain-free. And then if she would deviate from the diet with more greasy food, the pain would come back. So I thought, okay, this is looking positive, but then I felt a need to do a randomized clinical trial to test the diet. So my colleagues at Georgetown University in the Department of OBGYN worked with me to bring in a large group of women, and we showed that this diet does in fact change not only pain, but even PMS symptoms, like how your mood is and bloating and water retention and that kind of thing. And so we went further and looking at how you could change health through food. And to be clear, the reason that I made that dietary, somewhat outlandish sounding dietary recommendation for her is that we knew from breast cancer patients who, if they have too much estrogen in their blood, this female sex hormone will power the growth of cancer cells. And we also learned that if you have more high-fiber foods, that's vegetables and fruits and grains and beans, those high-fiber foods pull estrogen out of the body. The estrogen is filtered through the liver into the intestinal tract, and fiber carries it away. So when this young woman called and said, I got terrible pain, I thought, well, what's the matter with you? You've got too much thickening of your uterus every month. The uterine lining is thickening. That's what happens every month. I'll bet you have too much estrogen. And if I put a whole lot of high-fiber foods in your body, the next month, your estrogen level will be lower and you won't have so much cramps. And bingo, that was it. So there's much more to it than that. There are certain foods that have hormones. There are certain foods that increase the amount of hormones in your blood. But anyway, I just got excited that we could change things in the body and wanted people to know.
Now, at the sort of other end of the age spectrum in women, you know, you have a little bit in here about menopause as well. And so for many women, menopause can be quite devastating in terms of the hot flashes, or the medical term we use is vasomotor symptoms, that they have. But it turns out here, I guess I shouldn't be surprised, but I was pleasantly surprised to learn that this plant-based diet recommendation had an overwhelmingly positive impact in terms of diminishing some of the severity of those symptoms as well.
Yes, and I think you're touching on something very, very important. Is we started up talking about cramps, but what it really is the result of estrogen being out of balance. And that can be cramps, it can be endometriosis, it can be infertility, it could be breast cancer. But hot flashes, that this is where the heat rises up from your chest and you're perspiring, and very rapidly it's gone, and then it's followed by chills, and it just makes you feel like a mess, and it can happen at night and disturb your sleep 3, 4, 5 times a night, and it can be a tough thing. We don't know everything there is to know about this, but I was struck by the observation that in Japan in the 1960s, there was very little in the way of hot flashes. And what was the diet? Lots and lots of rice. Very little meat. Not even a whole lot of fish. It was used more as a flavoring for the rice. And no dairy, no ice cream, no grilled cheese sandwiches. And then the women did not report hot flashes. It was extremely rare. And at first you might think, well, they're just reticent. These are Japanese women. They don't want to talk about their health. But you just really could not elicit reports of hot flashes to any great degree until the diet westernized. And as the fast food chains brought in burgers and cheese, ice cream, the hot flashes became much more common. And so what we think is happening is that when women are raised on meaty, cheesy diets, their estrogen levels are chronically high. And that when they reach menopause and the ovaries stop making estrogen, you plummet from an artificially high level to a very low level, and then you just have these waves of hot flashes month after month after month. That's what we think is going on. I'm almost sure it's much more complex than that, but that's also led people to look at solutions, like put soy products into the diet. Japanese people eat lots of tofu and soy milk and that kind of thing. It doesn't help everybody, but it helps a lot of women. Losing weight seems to help, because that modifies estrogen too. So those are a couple of the takeaway messages that we have found.
And so we're talking about nutrition and hormones. And, you know, I think it deserves special mention, which is diabetes, which we tend not to think of as a hormonal disease, but in many ways is, because, of course, insulin is a hormone. And diabetes, you know, the statistics now show that 2/3 of Americans are overweight and 1/3 are technically defined as obese. And this is a huge problem. And as our waistlines and our weights rise, so too does diabetes. So we have an epidemic of diabetes in this country. And you didn't lead with diabetes, because I think this newer science may be more interesting, or perhaps more, it will spur more book sales. But you do focus on diabetes here. So can you just take us down the thinking on how a plant-based diet? You have great anecdotes in here, but also backed by lots of data and lots of multi-thousand-person studies showing literally reversal of diabetes through a plant-based diet. This was quite exciting to me.
It is, and we need a completely new view of diabetes and a much more optimistic one. And that's this. That diabetes means that there's something wrong with your blood sugar regulation, and the problem is insulin. Insulin is a hormone, and as you know, it's made in the pancreas, which is right behind your belly button, and the insulin gets into your bloodstream, and it travels to the cells of the body where it acts like a key. So the insulin key, its job, is to open up the cell membrane to let sugar get into the cell. The sugar is glucose, and it's the fuel for that cell. So that's insulin's whole job. It arrives at the surface of the cell and acts like a key to just let the glucose inside. So if a person has type 2 diabetes, their pancreas is making insulin, but the cells are somehow not responding. And if you look really, really closely, what you discover is that the insulin attaches to the surface of the cell, but it cannot open it up very well. What's happening is the cell has been filled up by microscopic fat particles. And you can see them on MR spectroscopy scanning. And these fat particles stop insulin from working. And so, now people are unaware of that. Doctors tend not to think about that, but it's true. And this means that the diet that could work the best for diabetes is one that doesn't have any fat in it, or very little. So our research team, funded by NIH, brought in a large group of people with type 2 diabetes. We took all the animal fat out of their diet. We used a completely plant-based diet. But we went further. We kept oils really low, too. And when you do that, the insulin starts working again because the fat is no longer in the cells. And the insulin works, and people get better. Their blood sugars fall. Their need for medication falls. And I will never forget, there was a policeman who came into the study. He'd had diabetes for, 5 years, something like that. His father was dead at 30. He was 31 when he got this disease. And he lost 60 pounds over about a year. His blood sugar numbers came down into the absolutely normal range. He stopped all his medications. And for all intents and purposes, he was cured. He did not have the disease anymore. I mean, no medication, no sign of the disease. And this was, 15 some years ago. And I was pacing around in my office for about 15 minutes trying to ask myself, could I tell him that he is now free of diabetes? Because we never saw that before. Diabetes was always a one-way street. And here was a man who had been cured. And I can laugh about it now because we see this all the time. Diabetes is very much a two-way street. But you have to realize that our goal of treatment is to get the fat out of your muscle cells and your liver cells. If you do that, you can cure this disease.
You are listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Neil Barnard. He is a faculty member at the George Washington University School of Medicine and the founder and president of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. He is author of the new book, Your Body in Balance, The New Science of Food, Hormones, and Health. And Neil Barnard, I'm curious, most of the chapters early on in the book anyway, to me anyway, as a reader reading it, trying to read it with lay reader eyes, seem to come to this final common pathway of go for the plant-based diet. For many people, I think that is an overwhelming proposition to go from our culture where meat is revered and where we think if we don't have meat at every meal or protein, a meat protein source, that we're going to go hungry. So you make some suggestions in the book that make the idea of lifestyle change a lot more palatable, where, for example, you just say, hey, start slow. Like, just even think about it for a week, or think about ways you could do it without even kind of making those drastic changes right away. And I thought this was really helpful. Could you elaborate on that a little?
Yeah, sure. And in fact, it does sound like a challenge. You know, if I'm going to go vegan, does that mean I have to acquire a taste for folk music? do I have to wear tie-dye? Do I have to tell people I'm now a philosopher? It conjures up all these crazy images. But the person that I was describing earlier who had diabetes, and the policeman here in Washington, he made a really interesting point when he was adopting this diet. Because he said, previous diabetes diets that he had been on told him he had to cut calories. And he said, that's tough. I mean, you go to bed hungry every single day. You know, I eat 2,000 calories. Now you're going to tell me I can only have 1,500 for every day of my life? And they made him count carb grams and all this stuff. And he said, you don't make me do any of that. Instead of meat chili, you eat bean chili. Instead of Alfredo sauce on my spaghetti, I have tomato sauce. How hard is that? So I was quite impressed that the patients didn't really think it was very hard, and it isn't. But nonetheless, we break it into two steps. The first step in changing your diet is to just take a week and just think about foods that you might eat if you were not eating animal products. So if you're having milk on your cereal, try almond milk. Or if you have sausage every day, try the veggie sausage. Or if you go to Subway and you get maybe a ham sandwich or something, try the veggie sandwich or the veggie burger somewhere. Or if you go to a Chinese restaurant, they've got probably 35 vegan things on their menu, vegetable dishes and tofu dishes, and just try them out. So anyway, take a week and find foods that you like. That's the first step. And after a week, you'll have figured it out. Then take 3 weeks. And here's the key. 3 weeks, actually do a vegan diet. No animal products. But that's easy now because it's only 3 weeks and because you already figured out the foods that you would like. And at the end of that 3-week period, you're physically healthier. Your weight is dropping. Your blood sugar is better. your digestion is better, and your the way you feel about foods changes. So you don't really miss the things that you thought you couldn't live without. And it's a really neat experience. And we always do that with our patients, and they do really, really, really well with it.
Now, there's also in the book, the sort of latter portion of the book is a series of recipes. So, you know, it's right here all in this one tome. You have a collaborator, Lindsay Nixon, who has planned menus for the reader or recipes. And I was just wondering a little bit about her.
Lindsay Nixon is really a genius in the kitchen. She is a recipe developer. And she, I worked with her. I asked her, could you give me 65 recipes for this book? And here are the guidelines. I want no animal products, high fiber, relatively few ingredients, easy to cook. And the final result has to be so delicious that a reluctant spouse will think this is good. You know, so, or you can feed it to your 15-year-old food dissecting kids. And she really succeeded. They're great recipes. But the best thing was when she sent me the recipes, she sent me a note, which I put in the book, which I wasn't expecting. She said, Dr. Barnard, the food changes that you describe here cured my menstrual cramps too. And I thought, okay, we're on to something. These problems are so pervasive that even the person I just asked to be my recipe developer had the very same issue. So she did well, and she really did beautifully with the recipes.
That's amazing. I didn't realize that. Well, also a part of the book, because of your work as president of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, you are concerned, ethically concerned, and an advocate for lessening our reliance on chemicals in food processing and otherwise, food growth, agriculture, and then also how we package food. And it's not a huge part of the book, but it was pretty interesting to me. I was wondering if you could just share with us a couple of chemicals that seem to come up in the news today. For one is BPA. We see a lot of this in the grocery stores now, these BPA-free cans. And so I was wondering if you could teach us about that and then this this other chemical, phthalates.
Yeah, just really quickly, I actually described this peculiar anecdote where some Harvard researchers did a study with Progresso soup, which I always thought had to be like the best soup on the shelf. You know, sounds kind of Italian. And they had research volunteers consume a vegetable soup from Progresso, and they found something called BPA in their urine. And it's bisphenol A, and it's what we call an endocrine disruptor. It's associated with changes in sperm counts and other endocrine changes that you don't want. And in fact, it's already restricted in kids, but in adults you can give it to them. And they discovered that it's in the lining of the can. The resin lining of a can has the BPA in it. So you can actually go to a health food store, and they will have cans that are BPA-free. And so you pick up a handful of BPA-free cans of soup, and you use your credit card at the cashier, and you walk out crumbling up your credit card slip, and unbeknownst to you, the thermal paper that the credit card slip was printed on has BPA impregnated in it that is now going through your skin. Cashiers who handle a lot of these slips, you can measure the BPA going into their bodies. So I'm raising this simply not to frighten people, but to let them know that there are chemicals they're exposed to and that you can take relatively simple steps to avoid them. So pick a BPA-free can if you wish, or make your own soup from scratch. And you can say, if when the cashier says, do you want your receipt? You can say, do you mind just tossing it for me? And you can avoid those. To tell the truth, what I'm perhaps more concerned about are the pesticides that are used because you really have no idea that they are there. And they are used quite frequently, and you can get some organic foods, but there are some foods in the store that you're not going to find as organic. So what do you do? And my recommendation is that people get organic whenever they can. And yes, it may cost more, although the cost differential is not usually huge. And from my standpoint, if the question is food with chemicals or food without chemicals, choose the one without chemicals. But there are some, if you cannot find organic with everything, there are some foods where it matters more, and so we give lists where organic foods are more important to choose.
Yeah, so late in the book, there is that list, and I guess it's safe to say that things that have, skin, I was going to say, are
right, appeal.
Appeal, yeah. So, for example, chemical treatments are used less often. I didn't know this. Avocados, sweet corn, pineapples, sweet peas, onions, papayas, eggplant, just to name a few. But the ones for where if you can get organic, you strongly advise to do so. And this is not just your list. This is the Environmental Working Group based on data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the top three, strawberries, spinach, and kale. And I guess, can you tell us why or what the theory is on that?
Well, there are really two issues here. One is the one that you mentioned. Let's say you get an avocado. You're not going to eat the avocado skin. So even if it was sprayed with a pesticide, if the pesticide is on the surface of it, you're going to discard that. So if you can't find an organic avocado, it's not such a big deal because you weren't going to eat the skin anyway. With a strawberry, you're not going to peel the strawberry. So if it was chemically treated, you're going to get the chemical. So that's why it's up on my list for something where organic is way better. But there's something else. There are certain foods that are more really fragile. So a leaf of spinach, for example, insects can tear it up very rapidly, whereas something like a pineapple, I mean, there's not so much they can do. You know, they don't have chainsaws and drills and so forth to get through that big pineapple. So the more fragile the plant, the more likely it is to be chemically treated. So you put those things together and you could just look at the Environmental Working Group has a very good site, and I link to them here with this because they update it every year to show you the foods where buying organic really matters the most. But that said, I think it's important to also realize that these chemical exposures are not the big problem. The reason that we have the health problems we do, for the most part, has nothing to do with chemicals that we're getting in foods. It has to do with the foods themselves. High-fat foods increase the amount of estrogen in a person's body. High-fat foods make us insulin resistant. A meaty diet that I grew up with causes our hormones to get a little bit haywire. And even if it's organic meat or cheese or something like that, it will still cause a problem.
Neil Barnard, you said you grew up eating meat, and I read from your bio that you grew up in Fargo, North Dakota. I was curious about your personal journey to a plant-based diet. How did you go from growing up on the plains of North Dakota to becoming plant-based yourself?
Yeah, the year before I went to medical school, I had a job in Minneapolis in the basement of the hospital. The hospital morgue was there, and I was the autopsy assistant. And whenever anybody died in the hospital, my job was to help the pathologist do the exam. And he knew that I was going to go to medical school, so he would give me these elaborate lectures over the bodies. And one day we had a man who had died in the hospital of a massive heart attack, probably from eating hospital food, but that's another story. So anyway, just kidding. he did, in fact, have this heart attack, and he had died, sadly. But the pathologist took a huge chunk of ribs off the front of the chest, as he always did, and he set the ribs on the table, and that exposed the heart. And he showed me the coronary arteries, and he would explain that they're called coronary because they crown the heart and feel it. And so I had gloves on, and I would put my finger inside the artery, and it was crispy. It was, you know, it was calcified, and it was frightening. And he would say, bacon and eggs, Neil. Anyway, so he would give me these lectures about what was causing what had killed these people. It was quite graphic. And on this particular day, he left the room and he was finished, and I had to clean up. So I put the ribs back in the chest, and I sewed up the skin and everything. And when I was done, I went up to the cafeteria. They were serving ribs for lunch.
Oh.
And I looked at them, and I thought, it looks just like the body. And they smelled like the dead body, and it suddenly hit me, that is a body. Now, I know this sounds silly because I had eaten this all my life, and my extended family raised cattle, and I myself drove cattle to slaughter, and I hunted and everything. But it suddenly just hit me that this is not something I am going to eat now. So that was the beginning of it. And then, of course, you learn much more, and your resolve becomes stronger.
Yeah, and so you went on to found the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. And in addition to advocating for a plant-based diet, one of the issues that you did mention was actually hospital food. And you've been successful. Your advocacy group, which claims, I think, over 100,000 members or supporters, in terms of getting at least some hospitals to alter their food choices, foods that they serve patients, I believe.
Well, let me say a word of praise for the American Medical Association. It has not been known for being on the forefront of nutritional advocacy. However, I brought a resolution to the AMA House of Delegates in, I think it was 2017, if I'm remembering right, where we were talking about hospital food. And, you know, it's true. A guy wakes up from having had a heart attack, and they feed him a hamburger the next day, the very foods that got him in there in the first place. And it's really been a scandal. And to the AMA's credit, the House of Delegates unanimously passed a resolution that I brought through the Medical Society of Washington, D.C., which said that hospitals must serve healthy foods, including plant-based meals. So Hospitals have to serve vegan stuff and should not serve bacon, sausage, ham, hot dogs, any of these processed meats that are linked to cancer, not to the patients, not to the visitors, and not to their own employees. Now, that's the AMA's position. Hospitals are still in the business of making money. So they often have vendors who sell all kinds of things that, unfortunately, are keeping the hospital wards full of sick people.
But, I mean, just getting that out there, I think, is a major accomplishment. I mean, it's nice to know, right, yeah, I agree, the AMA, not known for its progressive stances, is at least trying to promulgate a position practicing, or preach, I should say, what we should be practicing, right?
Oh,
which
yes.
is a healthy-based
yes.
behavior.
Yes, and hospitals are engaging. I mean, they understand that the writing is on the wall. When I was a resident, I used to smoke cigarettes. And my own hospital, George Washington University Hospital, I remember the discussions about, shall we ban tobacco in the hospital? Should we stop selling it in the gift shop? And now it sounds ridiculous that we ever had to even to discuss it. But a generation later, we're having the same discussions about should we be serving bacon, since even though we know it causes cancer. So we're going to win those. We're going to win those debates.
Now, one of the other major issues that the Physicians Committee stands for, I believe, is ethical treatment of animals or not using animals in laboratory or health-related research. I mean, how do you – that's a huge issue to take on. And how do you sort of choose the angle of your advocacy?
Well, for two reasons. Number one, everything we do as physicians has to have a basis in ethics. So if we train our medical students by giving them a dog and saying, okay, inject your dog with norepinephrine and write down what it does, if what you're doing has fundamental ethical flaws, you really shouldn't be doing it. And when we got started, there were laboratories like that were really quite widespread, and we've made a lot of effort to move away from it. But there's another piece of this. If I have a patient who's got diabetes in front of me and the research enterprise is not investigating what that person is eating that's affecting their health or different dietary patterns that could cure them, and instead they are trying to create diabetes in a rat or a mouse or trying to create a monkey model of Alzheimer's disease, I'm concerned that we're not only hurting the animals, but we're hurting our patients. Now, none of this means that the research enterprise is simple. It's not. And these are not easy questions. But our advocacy is to say we must focus on human biology, whether that means human genes or human tissues or human behavior or human populations. We have to look where the disease is. We have to understand it. And that's what our research has focused on. And I'm happy to say that even though we don't have all the answers yet, we have come up with such powerful interventions that if we really truly put to work what we know about using food to control hormones and to control other aspects of health so that people could regain their health, I am convinced that probably every clinic in North America could be closed down every Wednesday and Thursday because there just wouldn't be enough patients to come in and see them. That's kind of my dream, is to make doctors a little more unemployed. For now, they are busy dealing with diabetes and obesity and cardiovascular disease and things that are to a great degree preventable.
Well, the name of the book is Your Body in Balance, The New Science of Food, Hormones, and Health. And it's written by my guest today, Dr. Neil Barnard, who is the founder and president of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. He also serves on the faculty at the George Washington University School of Medicine. Neil Barnard, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been great talking with you today. Thank you.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.